Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
a shocking downfall. People in Baltimore woke up to discover a cargo ship had collided with a major bridge in their city and have watched it collapse into the water below.
It shouldn't be a tough pill to swallow. We'll hear from an abortion provider in Seattle who is holding her breath after the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case on limiting access to a crucial abortion drug.
Creatures of habitat. Scientists say one of the best ways to prevent future pandemics is to protect animal habitats. And they've got the black flying fox bats to prove it.
Calling it as they see it, before the first ever hockey broadcast in the Kaska language, elders had to come up with some new words. One of them tells us what it meant to say he shoots, he scores in his mother tongue.
A truly staggering achievement. I'll chat with the first woman to complete the infamously grueling Barkley marathons. She tells us about the torturous last stretch and the hallucinations that came with it.
And they went out with a boing. But 12 days after thieves stole thousands of hockey bobbleheads, Pittsburgh Penguins fans are bouncing back because the bobbleheads are too. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that's not surprised it took so long to find them, they had a head start. It was a disaster that seemed to play out in slow motion. In the video from early this morning, a massive cargo ship is seen heading straight for Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge. The lights on the ship flicker and go out and briefly come back on, and then the enormous ship, stacked high with shipping containers, rams into the bridge, sending the entire span into the water. Officials say the ship issued a mayday before it struck the bridge, which allowed cars to be stopped, likely preventing a much greater tragedy. But six construction workers who were on the bridge are missing and presumed dead. Alex Del Sordo owns a cafe at a marina close to the bridge. We reached him in Baltimore.
Alex, you were just out on the water. How close did you get?
There's a little island that used to be an old fortress. So I was just around the island, I'd say about 200 yards away from the wreck.
I know you've been watching it from your cafe where you are now up until that point. What was it like to see this up close? Describe it for our listeners.
Yeah, so the wind was coming out of the east, so there's a lot of chop on the water, and the wreckage, it's out of a movie. I don't know how else to describe it. Mm-hmm. The scene was incredibly uncomfortable. There were too many first responders to count. And it's absolute devastation. There were so much concrete. There's the ship is eerie. There's absolutely nobody on it. It's stuck in its position. The tide is slowly going out, so you're starting to see a little bit more exposure to the bottom there. Mm-hmm. Twisted iron and metal, and then again, there's just so many boats floating around. You can see that. The first responders are working very well together. You feel like you're in a movie.
I know first responders have been using the marina, but your cafe as well as a command center throughout all of this since early this morning. So what kinds of things are they sharing with you?
I had a chance to talk to the divers this morning who said that they're getting started right away, and that was at about 5:15 this morning. Throughout the day, there's just been a heavy rotation of first responders. Every about 2 hours, you'll see two or three boats come in, two or three boats go back out. We're getting notification that the Army Corps of Engineers are making their way here from other areas. So it sounds like everyone's getting to the scene. The ones that are sort of outside our area are coming in this evening, prepping for a big day tomorrow. And right now it's just search and rescue. And then tomorrow I think they're going to be starting a lot more of that dismantling the wreckage and getting deeper into it.
It's pretty stunning to see these images, just even, you know, a photograph or on television. This is a bridge you drive on every day, as tens of thousands of other cars, as we've heard from officials, do every day as well. So what is it like seeing that from your perspective?
Well, I thought about my commute home last night at 6:30 at night. I was driving home to my kids and wife, and I just take it like a normal bridge. I'm on it 2-3 times a day. It's the one bridge that I would take home, living in Annapolis, Maryland. And knowing that that could have been me is a very uncomfortable thought. And I don't know what I'm going to do moving forward. I mean, it was just it was in my backyard, basically. And to see it gone, it's something else to see it not there. I don't know how to describe it yet. I'm still kind of in shock, especially having been at the site. I was just there a few minutes ago, and it's just devastating.
It sounds chilling too to hear you describe it, honestly.
Yeah, I've experienced some pretty dramatic things over my life, but this thing tops it all. Especially the impact that it's going to have on our city. I have conversations with people all day long, and I've spoken to police officers who were at the port looking in, and they still don't know how to describe it. And we just talk about what this means to our city, and it's going to be devastating, the impact that it makes over the next couple of weeks and months. No, the families involved, we have friends and family here that are tied to the workers that participate in work on that bridge, and we still don't have news on what's going on, and just being around them is uncomfortable. You know, they're in shock.
Apart from the deep emotional impact that this has already had, in terms of the everyday logistics, the realities for your city, as you've said, what will it mean for people?
Well, you're going to have to get creative, I think, is probably the best way to say it. We have to find a way to continue working, the day-to-day. At the foot of the bridge, on the north side, are major companies like Amazon and Home Depot and major distribution networks that serve our entire community. There's major transport, it's a major artery. Right now, I'm even talking with my wife and employees here at Hard Yacht Cafe in Anchor Bay, and how are we going to solve this? You know, how are we going to get around this? And we're going to be patient. We're going to get creative and work our way around it.
What's your sense of how long it will take? Because this is not going to be a quick fix. Certainly, you don't need to be an expert to see that. But what are they telling you about what happens
next?
Yeah,
so the first responders, they're incredible people. It's like they have ice in their veins, and they're only thinking about what to do next. And when you look in their eyes and you look at the people who are involved, you can tell they're gonna react quickly, and they're gonna act with swiftness. So my gut tells me that the bridge in the area is gonna be cleared away very soon to try to open up some traffic. But to build a bridge that size, I can't imagine it takes less than years. I couldn't put a number on it beyond that. Mm-hmm.
There have been some questions that there could have been more protection around the bridge to prevent a hit from a cargo ship like this. Is that something that had been discussed in the area before this? I mean, I was reading that it was considered at least in fair condition, this bridge. There wasn't serious concerns about it, about its structural integrity, but this lack of a barrier has come up now.
Yeah, well, I guess it's easier to say that after the fact. I've been here for 20 years. I've gone over that bridge countless times. I've been on boats going under that bridge, and I've never been in conversations of better protection. It's a freak thing. I think as time goes on, we're going to learn a lot more. But from a boater's perspective, having been on this Chesapeake for 20 plus years, that's never crossed my mind or anybody else I've ever been communicating with.
Alex, I really appreciate your time. Please take care.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We reached cafe owner Alex Del Sordo in Baltimore. research papers about the COVID-19 pandemic abound, and the vast majority are understandably focused on its effects on human health. But a new paper published today is reminding readers that it's not just humans we should be thinking about, especially if we want to prevent the next pandemic. The study was conducted by more than 24 researchers from the fields of medicine, environmental science, biodiversity, food security, and more. And its authors say Australia's black flying fox bats can teach us a lot about keeping ourselves safe from future coronaviruses. Raina Plowright is a professor of public and ecosystem health at Cornell University and the lead author of the paper. We reached her in New Haven, Connecticut.
Professor Plowright, we're going to talk about the implications of the research you've done, but we have to talk about these bats first. My producer has used the word adorable to describe them. I'm not sure I agree, but why don't you tell us what they're like?
The bats we work on are rather large, actually. Yeah. They weigh about a kilo and have a wingspan the same as a bald eagle, and they are rather cute. They have these big beady eyes, which are really important for seeing in the dark, and little pointy noses. So they actually look like little foxes, and we call them flying foxes in Australia.
Everything you've listed does not sound adorable to me, but I can hear your care for them, and they are significant. What makes them such a good window to pandemic prevention?
Bats are a really important host of zoonotic viruses. These are viruses that are transmitted from animals to people. So bats host 4 of the 9 priority pathogens that WHO lists as potential for pandemics. Bats are also really sensitive to environmental change. So we tend to see them changing their distributions, becoming quite stressed if there isn't enough food to eat, or they don't have enough land to find where they need to go, find enough room to shelter, to sleep. And so we see them change their distributions, we see them shed pathogens when they lose their habitat.
Your research determined habitat loss led to more human encounters with these bats and more cases of the Hendra virus. On the other hand, you determined that the effects could be reversed. How?
That's right. When the bats lost their critical winter habitat, that is the trees that provided nectar for the bats in winter, the bats then had to move into human areas to find alternative food. So they moved into cities and farmlands and fed on things like mango trees in people's backyards. And when they were in these areas, they had much more overlap with humans and horses, which are actually the bridging host for this virus that they carry. But critically, we found that when some of the remaining winter trees flowered, so these what are now really rare habitats of winter flowering trees, mm-hmm. when they flowered, the bats actually left the cities, they left the farmlands, and went back into the native habitat. Every time that happened, the spillover event stopped. And so that just led us to this really natural solution to spillover, and that is to restore these critical habitats for bats. And then that should protect us from pandemics.
You're underlining something that scientists have argued in the past as well, that we need to reduce things such as habitat loss if we want to reduce the risk of future pandemics. But you've said, you know, as you underline this, that before it's a biomedical crisis, it's an ecological one. You're pointing out that maybe even still, after what the world has gone through, we're still more focused on pandemic preparedness than pandemic prevention. Why do you think that is?
Exactly. Yes. Just about all of the conversations we're having about mitigating the next pandemic are all focused on what do we do once the pathogen's already circulating in humans. And at that stage, it is a biomedical problem. We need vaccines and therapeutics and we need testing. But if we stopped the pathogen from getting into the human population in the first place, then we wouldn't have to even have those biomedical tools. So the actual process by which pathogens get into humans was what we call zoonotic spillover, and that's an ecological process.
How does industry factor into this?
Right. Well, industry usually involves building roads, and so pulling people into areas where they haven't been before. People need food, need protein, need shelter. That usually leads to more deforestation. It opens up new avenues of economic revenue, for example. hunting wild animals for meat, even guano mining, date palm sap consumption, all sorts of things where we can harvest things from the environment that bring us into closer contact potentially with animals and their excreta.
I know you've been focused on the bats and their habitats, but I wonder what your sense is of what you're hearing and seeing in your circles about an understanding of what you're underlining, that we have to focus on on prevention. Is there a shift, or have we just drifted back to where we were before?
Oh, I really think we've drifted back to where we were before. I just don't think there has been a shift. In fact, I think the whole world is really moving away as the pandemic sort of becomes a distant memory. We're really focusing on other things. I think, too, that as we're transforming landscapes, the risk of pandemics is becoming heightened. And I don't think there's a general awareness of this, but amongst my colleagues, we work in various parts of the world, particularly on bats and their viruses. What we're witnessing is just such extraordinary changes worldwide. And I have colleagues who work, say, in the Congo, whose field sites are now accessible through two-lane highways, whereas it took them days to get to them previously. And I have colleagues who used to basically have to walk through the jungle for days to get to their field sites in Southeast Asia. I have colleagues who work in East Africa who say the same thing. Just everywhere we look, everywhere we work, that the forests are disappearing. There is enormous road infrastructure being built, incredible access now to places that weren't accessible previously. And so all of these processes just are adding on to each other to bring humans and animals, especially in these novel associations between humans and animals that haven't had happened before, to make animals more stressed and more likely to be shedding pathogens.
Professor Plowright, I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Raina Plowright is a professor of public and ecosystem health at Cornell University. We reached her in New Haven, Connecticut. If you live in Canada, chances are very high that you've heard a hockey game broadcast at some point in your life, but not like this. That's part of the first ever hockey show in Kaska, a Dene language spoken in Canada's northwest. That play-by-play comes to us courtesy of CHONFM, the Indigenous radio station that aired the Kaska commentary over the weekend from the Yukon Native Hockey Tournament. And it uses words that, until a few weeks ago, didn't even exist. Two Kaska elders were behind the mic. You just heard Hammond Dick there. The other was Tesloa Smith, and we reached him in Whitehorse.
Tesloa Smith, what was your favorite part of the tournament?
My favorite part of the tournament was when we watched the Kaska Warriors. They had a couple of teams in there, and we did one of their games with the Kaska Warriors old-timers. Yeah, that was a good game. It was really close. I think they 2-1 the score they had.
But even before anyone hit the ice, you and a team of others had to come up with the words, a vocabulary list of hockey words, because they didn't already exist in Kaska. So how many words did you all end up creating?
Oh, we have a lot of words anyway. We got about, I don't know, 30 pages of words or somewhere on there. We have to think of all the movements, all the calls, like icing and things like that that they have on a hockey. It was a challenge. You know, we had a lot of help from a lot of elders that yeah. would participate in putting these words together. And myself and Hammond and young youth, both Emerald and Paul were youth workers with us. And they did a really good job of keeping track of all the words. And Pat Moore from UBC is a linguistic guy that helped us quite a bit too as well, mm-hmm. as how it's written with these different sounds that our language is put together with.
And how would you say, what do you say when someone scores?
first we say, you know, when he shoots, he say, this one, and then when you go in and score, we say, quite it.
So all together?
This one, quite it.
Yeah. And what are some of the other words that you put on this list? And I understand that you huddled together for about 3 weeks, so not a lot of time to come up with this new lexicon and phrase book.
Yeah. Well, we call the skate as in a cat. Mm-hmm. And we have, we call the stick, the hockey stick is the chin. The chin nana woody or the chin nana kaka.
And what is skate again?
Pez in a cat.
And that means in English, metal shoes with they play
metal
hockey.
Metal shoes, yeah. Oh. Yeah.
That's a direct translation. Mm-hmm. What did hockey mean to you growing up?
We grew up with hockey. Did lots of hockey when we were young at the mission school, and a lot of us got into hockey while there, I guess. And some of us got really good at playing hockey, and, mm-hmm. and we kept it up till all our lives, I guess. And we listened to hockey and NHL, and we have our own favorite teams and things like that.
You played at residential school. You were allowed to play, but you had to use English. You weren't allowed to speak your own language. How did hockey help you get through those difficult times?
Hockey help in a way that we can get away from the mission school for a while, mm-hmm. and get into sports like hockey, and it was good to be there, and you forget about whatever it was that you have to. Do at the mission school, so it was good to get on the ice and be yourself.
The language, the Keska language, was the only language you spoke until you were seven. A crucial part of your life as well. You're mm-hmm. you're one of only about 30 people who are still fluent in that language. We talked about what hockey meant to you. What did the language mean to you? Hanging on to it.
The language was. It's who we are, I think, in terms of keeping our language and speaking it. Yeah, there's only very few of our us that are fluently speaking the Keska, but there's a lot of others that understand it. They understand the language, especially the mission school kids. Their kids understand because they grew up with their grandparents speaking the language, and they have a lot of now programs, I guess, that are now geared to have our language again, spoken. Mm-hmm. And that's where this thing started. We had an elder gathering in Watson Lake about a month ago, I guess, and hockey became one of the topics at our gathering, and then just took off from there, I guess.
So you have this. You're going to put together this pamphlet. You have this broadcast. How do you hope that builds on the other work that you just talked about to make more people fluent in the language and revive it?
Yeah, I think this broadcast really opened a lot of doors, I guess, in terms of our language and what the languages can do. You know, it made people happy. We had a lot of feedback from people that listened to and understand the language, and they were really taken by it. You know, it gave them a good happiness. So when they hear that on a broadcast and on the radio, I think they made them proud about their language.
Is this going to become a regular thing? Are you going to broadcast more games in Keska?
I think now it's the door is a bit open now for indigenous language to go into hockey and hockey and maybe probably other sports too that they can do. And there's a lot of interest now to do similar things that we did.
Tesloa Smith, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Tesloa Smith is a Keska elder. He's in Whitehorse. One minute you're a Pittsburgh Penguins fan clearing space on your mantle. The next you're weeping into your vintage Mario Lemieux home jersey whispering, "This can't be real." But it was real. as one of these news people says at some point in this hopefully dramatic audio montage.
More breaking news the Penguins fans need to know about.
This is the big one.
The Pittsburgh Penguins are victims of cargo theft.
Have you seen this bobblehead? He's missing, along with a whole lot of his identical friends.
The Jaromír Jágr bobbleheads that were expected to be given out at tonight's game have been stolen.
Yeah, this is totally for real.
It was news that shocked Pens Nation. Jaromír Jágr bobbleheads, nearly 20,000 stolen somewhere between here and California.
It's pretty crazy, honestly. I was expecting a bobblehead now. I want a bobblehead.
So, someone stole a truck full of thousands of bobbleheads of retired Penguin superstar Jaromír Jágr that were supposed to be given away at a game earlier this month, and fans were horrified and flabbergasted, yet, as you heard, showing tremendous courage by acting not very interested. For 12 days, that horror and flabbergasticization reigned in Pittsburgh, a city teetering on the brink of total chaos, its very future in the hands of a mysterious gang of sick freaks who had kidnapped thousands of little boinging monuments to sports heroism. Would Pittsburghians ever see or hold their mini Jágrs, watch their little grinning heads bounce, and eventually put them in boxes in the basement? Yes, to however many questions that was. Yesterday, the Penguins issued a press release giddily announcing that, quote, a special cargo recovery team negotiated the return of the stolen property to a secure warehouse located in Ontario, California, unquote. No one knows what that sentence means, but we do know that everyone who is entitled to a Jágr bobblehead will receive one at last. Mayhem is defeated. Order is restored. Crucial tchotchkes are saved. And all those little bobbing heads prove it is springtime in Pittsburgh.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been less than 2 years since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and today the justices heard another case that could affect abortion access in that country. Today's case is focused on medication abortions, specifically access to the drug mifepristone, which was approved by the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, over 2 decades ago. Dr. Jamie Pfeiffer is the medical director of Abortion on Demand. We reached her in Seattle.
Dr. Pfeiffer, what have you been telling patients or people contacting you leading up to this case as you wait for a Supreme Court decision?
We at Abortion on Demand, we provide telehealth services in 24 U.S. states. And patients actually do not seem to be as aware of the mifepristone case as most of our abortion provider colleagues would be. People who don't think about abortion care all day, every day as their professional and personal life's work are not necessarily following the news about mifepristone. So we don't get a lot of questions from patients, although some those who do ask us, we reassure them that medication abortion is still available. It is still available via telehealth in the U.S., and that 2 decades of research and experience show that medication abortion is safe and effective. It's a normal part of our essential reproductive lives. And we reassure patients that the oral arguments today don't change our care model in the immediate future.
A decision might. How are you preparing for that?
It depends on how the decision goes. Mm-hmm. So we are considering adapting our model if the Supreme Court decides to roll back the FDA regulations to no longer allow telehealth dispensing. Now, the question before the court was, the 2016 and 2021 changes to restriction to mifepristone, and those included allowing dispensing via telehealth. They included later gestational age limits. And if the court did roll those back, it interestingly, the case never discussed misoprostol, which is the second of two medications in medication abortion care. Mm-hmm. And a misoprostol-only regimen would be safe and effective for patients via telehealth, and it wouldn't be under the guise of the same court case.
Why do you think they haven't addressed the second medication?
Because I think that this is a political stunt by the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. It is a political stunt that they don't like mifepristone and they don't like abortion care. Not that, you know, that they had any insight to the actual science of abortion care.
The Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine that you referred to before, one of the lead lawyers is Erin Hawley. She spoke today saying, quote, "The FDA betrayed women and girls when it unlawfully removed the necessary in-person doctor visits that protected women's health and well-being." And Erin Hawley goes on to call this reckless actions that jeopardize women's health and safety. So how would you respond to that?
The science doesn't support that. The science doesn't support the idea that an in-person visit makes a medication abortion, any safer. And I think in those oral arguments, even Amy Coney Barrett was questioning this concept that an ultrasound has never actually been required by the FDA. And standard of care across the world is that most medication abortions are performed without an ultrasound. So the idea that an in-person visit is adding anything but higher costs to patients and delaying care and providing more cumbersome barriers to access would be absurd.
A legal brief from medical societies, including the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, backs up what you're saying there. And they say mifepristone is, quote, exceptionally safe. The brief reads, when used in medication abortion, major adverse events, significant infection, excessive blood loss, or hospitalization occur in less than 0.32% of patients, according to a highly regarded study with more than 50,000 patients. Unquote. Are you concerned? I know you were saying you're not getting questions about this because, you know, people aren't following the intricacies and the legalities of these cases right now. They're getting in touch when they need medical help. But do you worry that this is confusing patients?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime there's media pushes around abortion care, and essentially when we're repeating the anti-abortion propaganda, it creates confusion for patients. I think that ultimately, if the Supreme Court does roll back access to mifepristone, it's going to result in people seeking abortion care later in their pregnancies with more complicated pregnancies. And they're going to be with fewer access points and frankly going to be more scared.
How are you handling all of this personally? You know, you're calm, you're a doctor, you're taking things in stride, at least it sounds in your voice. But, you know, we're talking about less than 2 years out from the Dobbs decision. We've got this case now, the headlines, the ongoing debate, as you know. What does it feel like for you personally to be at the point that you are in your country on this issue?
I am an abortion provider in a post-Dobbs world. My entire job is to remain calm right now. It has been a truly traumatic experience. No one who has been doing abortion care in the U.S. for as long as we have, which are, you know, our team has a collective probably 35 years of experience, was surprised by the Dobbs decision. We all knew, based on the politics of this court and the case, that that Roe was going to be overturned. That was not a surprise. What was surprising and frankly traumatic was the slow continuing rollout of worsening and worsening bans and worsening outcomes. So I'm glad I sound calm. I am mostly just tired. And I think that women in the U.S. are tired of this as well.
A law professor in California, Mary Ziegler, is telling the Washington Post that she feels it's clear the majority of justices don't believe these anti-abortion doctors in that alliance have standing to bring this case. And she's expecting the court to preserve access to mifepristone. What is your sense of where this case is going?
Well, I am much more hopeful after hearing the oral arguments than I was even a week ago. I think listening to them, it was pretty clear that, you know, I agree that it seemed that 6 to 7 out of the 9 justices also did not seem to think that AHM had any standing in this.
Dr. Pfeiffer, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Jamie Pfeiffer is the medical director of Abortion on Demand. We reached her in Seattle. Where can you find the best slice of cheese pizza in the world? If you guessed New York City, you're wrong. Chicago? Close, but not even close. No. Naples? Ding, ding, ding. That is the bell sound I make for wrong answers. The right answer is Hamilton, Ontario, home of Cowabunga Pizza, which just won Best Cheese Slice at the International Pizza Challenge in Las Vegas. But it almost didn't win. Because the key to Cowabunga's cheese pie is not actually the cheese. That's important, of course, but co-owner Andy Huynh says it's the crust that elevates the pizza. And he told CBC Toronto the dough almost didn't rise to the occasion.
We use a sourdough starter, which gives it some funk, and you know many other pizzerias don't do that because of how difficult it is to stay consistent.
You also let it sit.
Yeah, no. So we let it sit for 72 hours minimum. So it makes it a little bit tricky traveling across the country into the States with that baggage. And
well, as it turns out, that wasn't the trickiest part of trying to travel with your dough to this competition in Las Vegas. You check it in your bag, you get to Las Vegas, you go to baggage claim, and what's not there?
Our checked baggage. So obviously, that was something that I expected. So we typically bring a couple of doughs on the flight with us just so that we know we can make it over. And obviously, when we travel with dough, we want to keep it cool as possible. So I usually use a bag of frozen fruit and the carry-on to keep it cold. And then for the checked baggage, I put everything in a cooler with ice. That didn't make it, unfortunately. Not everything goes as smoothly as is planned. What we used to compete in first was what we brought on the plane. That was good enough to get us fourth place, which put us into the final round.
Yep.
We had about 24 hours to decide like the competition dough that we were going to use because we didn't have anything left. We called in one of our staff members at the shop to quickly book a flight. Within the next 24 hours.
An emergency dough run to Vegas.
Essentially, yeah. So we had the competition 7 a.m. on Thursday, and we had him fly in at midnight Wednesday night.
Wow.
So it was just like pretty much a buzzer beater moment.
That was Andy Huynh, the co-owner of Cowabunga Pizza in Hamilton, Ontario, talking to CBC Toronto host David Common about his award-winning cheese pizza. When I first learned about the Barkley Marathons, I thought, what? Followed by all the other question words, except for when. And the one I found myself repeating the most was, why? If you haven't heard of it before, the Barkley Marathons is an extremely extreme race against time in which runners navigate a 160-kilometer course through the rugged, brutal Tennessee wilderness. Participants have to complete the course in just 60 hours with few opportunities to sleep or eat, which is probably why only 20 people have finished it since the ultramarathon began in 1986. Well, on Friday, Jasmine Paris became the first ever woman to cross the Barkley Marathon's finish line. And she did it with only seconds to spare. We reached her today in Edinburgh, Scotland.
Jasmine, a couple of days to recover now. How are you feeling?
Thanks. I'm feeling pretty good. Kind of the excitement of it and the kind of joy and the elation of it's still there. But the body's definitely starting to recover and I'm feeling much better after sleep and food.
Yeah. When I was just looking at, as I was reading about your adventure, a photograph, I'm sure you've seen it, you know, eyes closed, mouth agape, just you've collapsed on the ground right after finishing. When you look at that photo or hear the coverage from when you finished the race, do you recognize that person? What do you see?
Yeah, I mean, the person looks exactly how I felt. So yeah, I knew I was kind of like running from the very last ounces of strength I had. I knew everything in me was screaming at me to stop. And I sort of actually had him, I sort of bargained in my head, you know, you desperately don't want to have to do this again. So give it everything you've got. And I sort of said to myself, well, you know, if you're either going to collapse before the gate or you're going to get there. And I just was so focused on the gate and everything else became sort of a little bit kind of peripheral and almost blurry at the kind of edges around me.
Were you ever screaming at yourself as to say, why did I do this at all?
Actually, not this year in the sense that I knew why I was doing it. I think I've already had two goes at this race. I knew what to expect. I knew it was going to be awful. I didn't question why I'm doing it because I knew I was doing it because I wanted to finish it. I did definitely kind of feel like say to myself, this is so hard. This is really awful. And I kind of didn't want to go out for another loop, but I never kind of questioned why I was doing it because I knew what that was. And that's why even when it was really hard, it wasn't really till I kind of was either out of time or I sort of collapsed and literally couldn't move that I was going to stop.
Yeah. Apart from that last stretch, and obviously there are so many aspects of this that are challenging, the distance, the time requirements, the terrain, but was there one of those things that was the most difficult for you?
There's lots of reasons why it's difficult, and it's those exactly that combination of things. It's the terrain, it's the fact that there's so much climbing, you know, like an insane amount of climbing compared with most races. And the navigation, it's the fact that you're kind of so alone, isolated out there. Obviously, if you're running with someone, that helps. But on the last loop, essentially, everyone's running on their own. And then there's so many kind of quirks to the race that you actually just have to kind of look past those and not let those kind of distract you, you know, because those are just kind of almost there to add an extra element of challenge to you mentally.
Is it true that you felt like you were hallucinating at some points as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's fairly standard. If you know, like, I've done quite a lot of long distance races and not slept, and like a cut tree where you've got the bit of wood pointing towards you, that, for example, turned into a lion's head. There was quite a lot of animals like lions, bears, pigs, an owl that I saw in the various trees and stumps around me. And then I saw kind of people in black anoraks as well on the hill above me. It was odd because they had a really kind of slightly foreboding appearance to them. But I genuinely believe they were there, and you're not supposed to walk off the trails in the park. So I was very surprised. But as I got closer, it wasn't people in black anoraks. And actually, I continued to see those all the way around.
Oh. What stage of the race is that happening in? How many hours in do those start?
Just in the last loop. So probably from 46 hours onwards.
And you are the first woman, as we've said, to finish this course. It's an achievement on many, many levels for anyone. But that aspect of it, what do you hope that signals? What message, if any, do you hope that sends?
Yeah, and I think I'm delighted in the sense that it seems to have inspired lots of people, not just women, but especially women, I guess, with what I guess you can achieve when you put your heart into something and you really give it your best. I'm kind of glad that I've got this kind of platform now that I can hopefully try and speak out and encourage that and encourage people to get active and women, you know, participating in sport and things.
I hear the excitement and the passion in your voice, albeit, you know, of course you're tired on this day, still recovering. But even with that, you know, there are people who are listening that cannot understand why you would put yourself through this. So what do you say to people who cannot understand why you would do this?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I love running because it takes me, you know, I run in the hills, so it takes me to the kind of wild places. The mountains give me a sense of perspective and peace, and it's kind of my time that I get away from work and the kids and just to be me. And I enjoy racing because I like the thrill of it. I enjoy, I'm competitive. So those are kind of the reasons I do running and racing. Why I would do an event like this? Well, I think really it's because it's exciting to challenge yourself with something where you don't know whether you can do it. Because if we spend all our life doing just things that we can do, then we'll never really know what we can achieve if we push ourselves further. And so I guess I look for things, and they can't do it too often because you kind of break yourself. But if you look for things that are going to challenge you, then that's when you kind of really grow, I guess, and find out more about yourself. And that's when, you know, for a race like Barkley, you know that you're going to hit the wall. So then you're going to have to work out what you're going to do. Are you going to kind of pick yourself up and work out a way round and kind of scale that? Or are you going to give up, you know? And I think that when you do persevere and push through, and like I finished Barkley, then it gives you this incredible confidence going forward. And it's like it stands out as a moment of kind of brightness and kind of vivid moment in when you look back on your life.
Jasmine, congratulations again. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Jasmine Paris is the first woman to finish the Barkley Marathons. We reached her in Edinburgh, Scotland. Airports are notorious for their tight security, but somehow Athena was able to slip by unseen. Athena is a gray tabby cat who is pregnant. She was on a plane from Winnipeg to Ottawa, where she was about to start fresh with her new litter, but last week she escaped from her carrying case and she hasn't been seen since. Marta Berchitska is a volunteer with Furry Tales Rescue, and Janice Richard is the independent trapper leading the search for Athena. Ms. Richard told the CBC where she's been looking.
Pretty much everywhere that I can think a cat would go. There's not a lot of hiding places in the parking garage that she got out in, other than cars, trucks. And there was one room that was gated off, but the airport has been amazing and they've given me, you know, carte blanche to go pretty much where I want to. So we searched that room extensively and she's not there. We've left food. The food has not been eaten. So we think that she, right now, that she has left the garage area and is out on the grounds somewhere. Marta and I were out last night looking all over through the dumpster area, thinking that because that's where she sort of came from, that she may migrate to that area. But so far, we haven't seen any signs of that.
I understand that you brought in a yappy cat, a very vocal cat. Can you share that strategy?
Yeah, our good friend Jojo has a wonderful cat and he's a little vocal. And I thought if we brought him in and he was talking that she may talk back to him. And she did the first night. We heard three meows. However, trying to pin them down was very difficult because at that point in time, it was very noisy at the airport with people coming in and people going out and cars and everything. And I just could not find her. I just could not. I don't know if at that time she was actually under a car, in a car engine, or over behind the cement wall on the grounds.
Marta, we mentioned at the outset that Athena is quite pregnant. What does that mean? I mean, how close is she to delivery and what activity, what might she do when it becomes close to her due date?
So the stakes are very high. It's still quite cold, especially in the evenings. It's quite cold. The airport's a very windy place, exposed, lots of exposed areas. There are foxes on the grounds. So Athena's going to look for a place to nest. And during that time, you know, she's going to have to leave her kittens unattended once they're born in order to hunt. And this puts her kittens at risk, obviously, of predators and of exposure. And food can be scarce, you know, if she finds a place that's very much out of the way and there isn't a whole lot of food around, you know, they're all at risk for starvation.
Marta Berchitska and before her Janice Richard talking about Athena, the pregnant tabby cat, who's missing inside Ottawa's airport. They were You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.